BTO Beyond the Obvious, der Ökonomie-Podcast mit Dr. Daniel Stelter. Featured bei Handelsblatt.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zur neuesten Ausgabe meines Podcasts. In dieser Woche sprechen wir über Stablecoins. Jetzt werden Sie sagen, ach, das kenne ich doch. Das ist dieses Instrument, mit dem Donald Trump sich die Finanzierung des amerikanischen Staates sichern möchte. Nach dem Motto, kauft er die Stablecoins, die Stablecoins kaufen dann Staatsanleihen, und zwar unendlich viele. Doch damit ist es nicht getan. Die Amerikaner hoffen darauf, diese Stablecoins quasi weltweit zu etablieren, um damit zum einen die Finanzierung des Staates zu sichern, indem auch Ausländer leicht in Stablecoins und damit US-Staatsanleihen investieren können. Und zum anderen setzen sie darauf, dass über die Stablecoins der US-Dollar weiterhin die dominante Kraft im Finanzwesen bleibt. Was bedeutet es für Europa? Nun, Europa sollte versuchen, strategische Autonomie zu erzielen. Dazu gibt es konkrete Vorschläge. Diese Vorschläge werden jedoch von der EZB nicht begrüßt. Im Gegenteil, die EZB sieht sie sehr kritisch. Ich denke, erneut ist die EZB auf dem falschen Weg. Wir hören uns an, wo die Probleme sind, was die Lösung wäre und was dafür spricht, sich gegen die Haltung der EZB zu wenden und quasi auf diese Art und Weise mehr Autonomie für den Euro und für die Eurozone zu erhalten. Das Ganze ist, Sie werden es sehen, hochrelevant, hochspannend. Ich hoffe sehr, dass Sie es auch so sehen. Deshalb würde ich vorschlagen, fangen wir einfach an.
BTO Beyond the Obvious, featured bei Handelsblatt.
Im Mai trafen sich die EU-Finanzminister und die europäischen Notenbankgouverneure zu einer informellen Sitzung auf Zypern. Sie diskutierten die Zukunft der Geldpolitik und sie diskutierten auch grundsätzliche Themen. Mit dabei waren zwei Ökonomen, Lucretia Reichlin und Jeremy Zettelmeier vom Brüsseler Think Tank Brügel. Sie stellten ein Papier vor zur Zukunft der digitalen Zahlungsmittel in Europa. Konkret ging es um die Regulierung von Stablecoins, also jenen digitalen Zahlungsmittel, die 1:1 an eine Währung wie den Dollar oder den Euro gekoppelt sind. Der Vorschlag traf nicht auf offene Ohren, im Gegenteil. Reuters titelte, die EZB weist die Vorschläge als zu riskant zurück. Quellen berichten, dass Christine Lagarde persönlich den Vorschlag abgelehnt habe. Das ist interessant. Es gibt also einen Vorschlag zum Thema Stablecoins und die EZB lehnt diesen ab. Jetzt könnten wir an dieser Stelle sagen, die Notenbanker wissen alles, deshalb haben die recht, oder wir gehen der Frage nach, ob unter Umständen die EZB hier auf dem Holzweg ist. Sie ahnen es bereits, vermutlich ist sie auf dem Holzweg. Doch zunächst blicken wir mal auf die Szene generell. Wir wissen, es gibt in den USA eine starke Bewegung zugunsten von Stablecoins. Die Amerikaner sind hier sehr aktiv und der US-Finanzminister Scott Bessent hat gemäß New York Times Folgendes gesagt. Ich zitiere, wir werden dafür sorgen, dass der US-Dollar die dominierende Reservewährung der Welt bleibt und wir werden dazu Stablecoins nutzen. Wenn Scott Bessent das sagt, ist das keine Nebenbemerkung. Das ist eine konkrete Strategie. Stablecoins sind für Washington ein Hebel, um die Dollarvormacht in die digitale Welt zu verlängern. Und noch etwas weiteres. Stablecoin-Emittenten halten ihre Reserven überwiegend in US-Staatsanleihen. Sie sind damit ein zusätzlicher Käufer der amerikanischen Rekordschulden. Und Bessent denkt so gesehen bei Stablecoins an zwei Dinge. Zum einen an die Hegemonie des Dollars, zum anderen an die eigene Finanzierung. Die EZB hingegen sieht in Stablecoins vor allem eine Gefahr. Die Frage, der wir jetzt nachgehen wollen, ist, hat sie recht oder ist sie dabei, die digitale Souveränität im Finanzbereich zu verspielen? Dazu gehen wir 4 Schritten vor. Zunächst ein kurzer Blick auf, was Stablecoins wirklich sind und wie groß ihre Bedeutung mittlerweile ist. Zum Zweiten, warum es nicht so sehr darum geht, ob jetzt Sie oder ich Stablecoins halten, sondern wie die Abwicklung von Prozessen am Kapitalmarkt funktioniert. Stichwort Infrastruktur. Und drittens werde ich dann darauf eingehen, was die Professoren Reichlin und Zettelmeier konkret vorgeschlagen haben, bevor wir dann zu einem Gespräch mit den beiden Akteuren kommen. Zunächst zur Bedeutung von Stablecoins. Ich denke, die meisten erschätzen, wie groß der Markt für Stablecoins bereits geworden ist. Das globale Transaktionsvolumen lag im vergangenen Jahr bei ca. 28 bis 33 Billionen Dollar. Das heißt, schon jetzt werden Stablecoins gehandelt in einem Volumen, welches größer ist als die gesamte Wirtschaftsleistung der Vereinigten Staaten in einem Jahr. Auch in Europa gewinnt Stablecoins an Bedeutung. Aber noch dominiert der US-Dollar. Der Anteil aller Euro-Stablecoins am globalen Angebot liegt bei unter 1%. Trotzdem laufen inzwischen fast 4 von 10 Stablecoin-Transaktionen bereits in Europa, aber eben nicht in Euro, sondern in Dollar. Und genau das ist der Punkt, auf den das Bruegel-Papier eingeht und den quasi die Autoren problematisieren. Sie sagen, ein zunehmender Anteil der mit Europa verbundenen Transaktionen in Kryptoassets wird in tokenisierten US-Dollar statt in Euro abgewickelt. Das heißt, wir sind bereits im Prozess einer digitalen Dollarisierung. Nur haben es die meisten in Europa noch nicht ermerkt und sehen auch nicht die Problematik. Aber das ist zunächst erstmal nur die Datengrundlage. Es wird noch viel interessanter. Wenn wir über Stablecoin sprechen, denken die meisten an Endnutzer, die mit dem Handy in Dollar bezahlen. Das ist die Retail-Seite, das Geschäft für Privatkunden. Die ist natürlich wichtig, aber sie ist eigentlich nicht das entscheidende Schlachtfeld. Das eigene Schlachtfeld ist der sogenannte Wholesale. Das heißt, das Geschäft zwischen Finanzinstituten, also zwischen Banken, Fonds, Versicherungen und Wertpapierhändlern. Die großen Wertpapiertransaktionen, die Bewegungen von Pfändern, dem sogenannten Collateral, aber auch die Repo-Geschäfte werden quasi zwischen diesen Großhandelsakteuren abgewickelt. Und genau dort verändert die Digitalisierung gerade die Grundstrukturen grundsätzlich. Dass dort der Euro an Bedeutung verliert, ist besonders problematisch. Vielleicht ganz kurz, was da passiert. Jeder Wertpapierhandel hat 2 Seiten. Der Verkäufer liefert das Wertpapier, der Käufer zahlt das Geld. Im Prinzip, was wir alle kennen, nicht Ware gegen Geld. Man spricht hierbei von Delivery versus Payment. Man möchte im Finanzbereich, gerade im Finanzbereich, möglichst eine Zeitgleichheit zwischen beiden Transaktionen, also der Überweisung wie auch der Übertragung des Wertpapiers. Je enger beide Bewegungen gekoppelt sind, desto sicher ist es. In der Vergangenheit gab es immer wieder Probleme, wenn Zeitverzögerungen auftraten. Da wurde bezahlt, ohne dass die Wertpapiere kamen oder umgekehrt. In Europa läuft es heute so. Das Wertpapier liegt im Depot beim Zentralverwahrer, wie beispielsweise Clearstream. Das Geld liegt auf einem Konto bei der Zentralbank und wird dann über das Target-System weitergereicht. Beide Systeme sind gekoppelt, sodass bei jeder Transaktion Wertpapier und Geld synchron übertragen werden. Das ist quasi der Ist-Zustand. Die Tokenisierung, quasi die Digitalisierung, ändert genau das. Je mehr Wertpapiere tokenisiert werden, je mehr erfolgt eine andere Abwicklung. Die Wertpapiere werden dann nicht mehr als Buchungsposition beim Zentralverwahrer geführt, sondern als Token auf einer Blockchain oder einer ähnlichen Plattform. Eine grüne Anleihe beispielsweise auf Ethereum, ein Fondsanteil auf einer Konsortial-Blockchain, ein Repo-Kollateral auf einer institutionellen Plattform. Und diese Migration quasi aus der alten Welt in die digitale Welt passiert gerade. Und dann stellt sich die Frage, wie läuft die Transaktion ab? Vor allem, wie läuft die Geldzahlung ab? Das digitale Geld muss quasi zeitgleich mit dem tokenisierten Wertpapier bewegt werden. Hier gibt es 3 mögliche Antworten. Die erste Antwort ist, beides befindet sich auf derselben Plattform. Also beispielsweise das Wertpapier ist auf Ethereum und das Geld ist auch auf Ethereum als Dollar-Stablecoin. Der Trade läuft dann quasi in einer Millisekunde. Das ist die reinste Form der Lieferung gegen Zahlung, die man sich vorstellen kann. Die zweite Antwort ist, das Geld bleibt bei der EZB. Das Wertpapier ist also auf einer Blockchain, das Geld weiterhin im Target-Finanzsystem. Dazu braucht es eine Brücke zwischen beiden Tools. Die EZB arbeitet daran mit dem sogenannten Projekt Pontes, eben Brücke. Der Nachteil von solchen Brücken ist, die Bewegungen sind nicht mehr hundertprozentig synchron. Es gibt kein echtes, sehr zeitnahes Delivery versus Payment. Die dritte Antwort wäre, das Geld ist auf einer anderen Blockchain. Dazu gibt es sogenannte Cross-Chain-Brücken. Die sind technisch aufwendig und in den letzten Jahren schon mehrfach gehackt worden mit entsprechenden Millionenverlusten. Das heißt, die erste Antwort, beides auf derselben Plattform, ist die technisch beste Antwort. Und weil aktuell die einzige liquide On-Chain-Währung eben US-Dollar-Stablecoins sind, wandert die gesamte Wholesale-Aktivität dorthin. Es kann also sein, dass selbst wenn beide Handelspartner in Europa sitzen und das Wertpapier ein europäisches ist, letztlich der US-Dollar-Stablecoin die Cash-Transaktion abbildet. Reichlin und Zettelmeier sprechen denn auch von Infrastructure Dollarization, also der Dollarisierung der Infrastruktur. Nicht die Nachfrage der Haushalte nach Dollarkonten, sondern die Verankerung der Kapitalmarktinstallation in einem fremden privaten Zahlungsinstrument führen dazu, dass der Dollar dominiert. Die schreiben konkret Folgendes. Der Euro würde der inländische Währungsanker bleiben, doch seine operative zentrale Rolle in digitalen Marktinfrastrukturen würde abnehmen. Die würde eben durch den US-Dollar ersetzt werden. Das ist der entscheidende Satz. Der Euro bleibt zwar gesetzliches Zahlungsmittel, aber seine operative Bedeutung in der tokenisierten Finanzwelt schwindet. Vor allem eins muss man im Hinterkopf haben. Sobald so ein System erst einmal existiert, dürfte es sehr, sehr schwer sein, davon wegzukommen. Und genau deshalb finde ich den Ansatz der Überlegungen in dem Prügelpapier so interessant und ist so erstaunlich gleichzeitig, dass die EZB so negativ auf die Ideen reagiert hat.
Unsere Welt wird immer verrückter, auch wenn das vielleicht etwas populär ausgedrückt ist. Aber ein Blick in die Newsportale reicht, um dem subjektiven Eindruck etwas Objektives abzugewinnen. Das Weltgeschehen ist im Wettlauf mit sich selbst und übertrifft sich dabei scheinbar täglich. Diese Dynamik und die dahinter steckenden Ereignisse bleiben nicht ohne Auswirkungen auf die Energiepreise. Jeder merkt das. Schließlich geht es nicht nur an den Tankstellen hoch und runter. Bei Strom- und Gastarifen ist das ähnlich. In dieser Lage ist es wirklich schwer, unter den mehreren hundert Energielieferanten in Deutschland einen günstigen Anbieter zu finden und das jedes Jahr aufs Neue. Zum Glück hat Wechselpilot da den Überblick. Und mehr noch, Wechselpilot prüft regelmäßig Tarife, behält Fristen im Blick und kümmert sich um einen Wechsel automatisch und kontinuierlich. Aber keine Sorge, du behältst jederzeit die Übersicht. Du registrierst dich, teilst deine Tarifpräferenzen und Wechselpilot schlägt passende Tarife vor. Nach deiner Entscheidung geht dann alles seinen Gang und zwar dauerhaft. Wechselpilot kümmert sich jedes Jahr automatisch um den Tarifvergleich, den Wechsel und die Kommunikation mit dem Versorger. Im Ergebnis sparst du nicht nur Zeit, sondern auch ordentlich Geld. Der Großteil davon bleibt bei dir und Wechselpilot bekommt einen prozentualen Anteil für seinen Service. Die Gebühr basiert auf dem Erfolg, heißt, eine größere Ersparnis lohnt sich für dich und für Wechselpilot. Du zahlst nur dann etwas, wenn du auch wirklich sparst. Das ist fair. Für deinen ersten Wechsel bekommst du mit dem Code BTO20 zusätzlich 20 Euro Cashback. Über den Link in den Shownotes kannst du es ausprobieren und das Energiethema danach vergessen, denn mit Wechselpilot musst du nie wieder zu viel für Energie bezahlen. Quasi der letzte Stromwechsel deines Lebens. Übrigens, der TÜV sagt zu Wechselpilot sehr gut. Ein durchschnittlicher Haushalt spart ca. 360 Euro pro Jahr und über 400.000 durchgeführte Wechsel sprechen für sich. Mehr Informationen und den BTO-Code findest du in den Shownotes.
Bevor wir weitermachen und das Thema noch genauer betrachten, vielleicht kurz dieser Hinweis des Handelsblatts. Nach wie vor gibt es ein exklusives Angebot für alle BTO Beyond the Obvious, featured bei Handelsblatt-Hörer. Testen Sie das Handelsblatt Premium für eine 4 Wochen lang für nur 1 Euro und bleiben Sie so zur aktuellen Wirtschafts- und Finanzlage informiert. Weitere Informationen finden Sie unter handelsblatt.com/mehrperspektiven und wie immer auch in den Shownotes zu dieser Ausgabe. Reichlin und Zettelmeier schlagen vor, dass die EZB bestimmte Regelungen ändert, um so den Euro zur wichtigen Infrastrukturwährung zu machen. Konkret haben sie 4 Punkte vorgeschlagen. Erstens, die EZB sollte das sogenannte Appia-Projekt beschleunigen. Bei Appia geht es darum, die neuen Blockchain-Plattformen mit der klassischen EZB-Zahlungsinfrastruktur zu verbinden. Ohne Appia geht Europa im Wholesale-Rennen unter. Das heißt, aber übersetzt, sie sagen, wir sollen diese Brücke aus dem Blockchain-Welt zum Zentralbank-Infrastruktur, die nicht ganz optimal ist, aber besser als gar nichts, möglichst schnell ans Laufen kriegen. Zweitens, die Regeln der europäischen Kryptoregulierungen sind zu reformieren. Konkret geht es darum, dass zurzeit Stablecoin-Emittenten gezwungen werden, den Großteil ihrer Einlagen wiederum als Bankeinlagen zu halten. Das mag gut gemeint sein, vor allem für die Banken, es benachteiligt aber Euro-Stablecoins strukturell gegenüber US-Dollar-Stablecoins, einfach deshalb, weil weniger Ertrag erwirtschaftet wird. Drittens, auch das ist revolutionär, fordern die beiden, es sollte möglich sein, die Stablecoins für die Halter zu verzinsen. Sie wollen dies zwar zu einem Zinssatz machen, der unter dem EZB-Einlagenzins liegt und damit die Attraktivität reduzieren, damit Bankeinlagen weiterhin attraktiver bleiben. Dennoch ist es eine Logik, um auf diese Art und Weise Stablecoins attraktiver zu machen. Der vierte Vorschlag der beiden Autoren ist folgender. Sie wollen, dass die EU-regulierten Stablecoin-Emittenten Zugang zur EZB-Bilanz haben. Was ist damit gemeint? Es geht darum, dass im Falle einer Krise, einer Liquiditätsknappheit, die Stablecoin-Emittenten genauso wie Banken auf die Rettung und Unterstützung der EZB setzen können. Das ist sicherlich eine Provokation für die EZB, die ganz klar im Fokus hat, das europäische Bankensystem zu erhalten und zu schützen und zu stützen. Auf der anderen Seite ist es aber nichts anderes als realistische Anerkennung dessen, was ohnehin passiert. Sollte nämlich wirklich eine Krise sein und die Stablecoins beispielsweise in Probleme geraten, dann würden die Notenbanken ohnehin intervenieren. Lieber gleich von vorne an klar machen, dass so eine Intervention möglich ist. Man kann es hier mit entsprechender Aufsicht verbinden. Wie bereits anfangs gesagt, hat die EZB auf die Vorschläge nicht gerade positiv reagiert. Reuters meldete ganz konkret aus der Sitzung von der COSIA, dass, ich zitiere, die Vorschläge auf sofortigen Widerstand seitens der Zentralbanker, darunter EZB-Präsidentin Christine Lagarde, getroffen sind. Sofortiger Widerstand von Christine Lagarde persönlich. Mehrere andere Zentralbanker stellten die Idee offen in Frage, die EZB als Kreditgeber der letzten Instanz für Stablecoin-Emittenten agieren zu lassen. Die Finanzminister im Raum hatten dagegen laut Reuters gemischte Meinungen. Das überrascht mich nicht, vermutlich haben sie es ohnehin nicht im Detail verstanden. Ich dachte mir, das lohnt sich auf jeden Fall. Wir haben hier zwei hochanerkannte Ökonomen, die interessanten Vorschlag machen und dieser Vorschlag wird von der EZB so eindeutig und brüsk abgelehnt. Genau deshalb habe ich mir gedacht, es lohnt sich, mit Ihnen zu sprechen. Und genau das machen wir jetzt.
Viele schauen beim Trading zuerst auf die Strategie. Dabei wird oft vergessen, dass auch die Ausführung selbst einen Unterschied machen kann. Also, wie schnell wird ein Trade ausgeführt, wie eng sind die Spreads und wie direkt ist eigentlich der Marktzugang? Genau an dem Punkt setzt TradeGate Direct an. Die App richtet sich an aktive und erfahrene Trader, die bewusst handeln und mehr Kontrolle über ihre Orders haben möchten. Gehandelt wird direkt über die TradeGate BSX ohne externe Intermediäre zwischen Order und Börse. Gerade bei häufigerem Trading spielen Themen wie Liquidität, Spreads oder Slippage eine größere Rolle, als viele denken. Deshalb setzt TradeGate Direct auf transparente Ausführung, professionelle Ordertypen und tiefe Performance-Reportings, mit denen sich das eigene Trading detaillierter auswerten lässt. TradeGate Direct wurde bereits zweimal in Folge von Stiftung Warentest als Kostensieger ausgezeichnet. Dazu kommen lange Handelszeiten von 7.30 Uhr bis 22 Uhr und dauerhaft kostenfreies Trading. Marktübliche Spreads können natürlich anfallen. Hinter der Trading-App steht die Berliner TradeGate AG, ein Unternehmen mit über 30 Jahren Erfahrung im Finanzmarktbereich. Wenn Sie sich das anschauen möchten, unter tradegate.direct finden Sie alle Informationen zur App und den Funktionen. Den Link gibt's in den Shownotes. Lucretia Reichlin ist Professorin für Ökonomie an der London Business School und Non-Resident Fellow am Bruegel-Institut. Von 2005 bis 2008 war sie Director General of Research bei der Europäischen Zentralbank, die höchste akademische Position innerhalb der EZB. Sie war Vorstandsmitglied bei verschiedenen Finanzinstituten, darunter UniCredit und Morgan Stanley International, Beraterinnen für mehrere Zentralbanken, darunter die US-Notenbank, sowie Kuratoriumsmitglied der International Financial Reporting Standards Foundation. Und Dr. Jeromin Zettelmeier ist Direktor des Bruegel-Instituts, des führenden europäischen Wirtschafts-Thinktanks. Zuvor war er stellvertretender Direktor der Abteilung Strategy and Policy Review beim IWF, Senior Fellow am Peterson Institute for International Economics, Generaldirektor für Wirtschaftspolitik im Bundesministerium für Wirtschaft und Energie sowie stellvertretender Chefvolkswirt und Forschungsdirektor bei der Europäischen Bank für Wiederaufbau und Entwicklung. Er promovierte am MIT im Fach Volkswirtschaftslehre.
Wie immer bei englischsprachigen Interviews folgen nun einige Highlights auf Deutsch. Das gesamte Gespräch im Original dann, wie immer, am Ende dieses Podcasts. Zunächst habe ich gefragt, was Stablecoins überhaupt sind und wie sie sich von dem, was wir als Geld kennen, unterscheiden. Lucrezia Reichlin ordnet ein, warum die Aufseher in den USA und in Europa auf diese Frage bislang sehr unterschiedliche Antworten gefunden haben.
Okay, Stablecoin is issued by the private sector, non-bank private sectors. You know, they issue something which looks like money.
Ein Stablecoin wird von privaten Sektor herausgegeben, und zwar von Nichtbanken. Diese Emittenten geben etwas aus, was aussieht wie Geld und auf der Aktivseite mit sicheren Vermögenswerten unterlegt ist. Weil die Qualität dieser Sicherheiten hoch ist, besteht im Prinzip kaum ein Risiko bei der Rücknahme. All das ist im Finanzsektor natürlich noch relativ neu. Entsprechend versuchen die Regulierer gerade zu verstehen, was das eigentlich bedeutet. Wie verhält sich ein Stablecoin zur Bankeinlage? Ist das Geld oder ist es etwas anderes? Ähnelt es eher einem Geldmarktfonds oder eher dem Bargeld? Die Aufsichtsbehörden sind dabei zu unterschiedlichen Antworten gekommen. In den USA haben wir den Genius Act, in Europa die MiCA-Verordnung.
Regulators have taken a different stance on how to regulate it. Okay, so in the US we have the Genius Act and in Europe we had MiCA.
In den Schwellenländern ist die Dollarisierung längst Alltag. Neu ist nur die Technologie, mit der sie stattfindet. Jeromin Zettelmeier beschreibt, was sich für jemand ändert, der seine Ersparnisse bisher in Bar oder bei einer lokalen Bank in Dollar hielt. Und warum die USA vor einer bemerkenswert starken Ausgangslage aus starten.
Now in the past, that entailed some risks on its own. And among these were risks that, you know,
früher war das allerdings mit ganz eigenen Risiken verbunden, etwa mit der Frage, wo man diese Dollar überhaupt aufbewahrt. Hält man sie physisch? Muss man dafür nach Miami reisen? Oder legt man sie bei einer lokalen Bank an, was gut gehen kann, aber diese Bank ist eben Teil eines lokalen Finanzgeflechts, das selbst nicht unbedingt sicher ist? All diese Kosten und Risiken, die das Halten von US-Dollar in analoger Form mit sich brachte, werden durch Stablecoins verringert oder fallen ganz weg. Damit könnte die Dollarisierung zusätzlich Schub bekommen, weil es sehr viel einfacher und sicherer wird, bargeldähnliche Forderungen in US-Dollar zu halten. Von dieser Ausgangslage aus starten die USA, und das ist eine sehr starke Position.
US-Dollar-Claims. So that's where the US starts from a very strong position.
Der zentrale Begriff des Papiers der beiden heißt Infrastruktur-Dollarisierung. Und er wird nach Reichlins Beobachtung regelmäßig missverstanden. Es geht dabei gerade nicht um Verbraucher, die lieber Dollar als Euro halten wollen, sondern um die Frage, in welcher Währung die tokenisierte Finanzwelt am Ende abrechnen wird.
It's a very important concept that people have not fully understood, because
genau das meinen wir in unserem Papier mit Infrastruktur-Dollarisierung. Das ist ein sehr wichtiges Konzept, das bislang kaum jemand vollständig erfasst hat. Denn wenn man darin ein Risiko sieht, muss man die Zahlen und die Entwicklung der Stablecoins ganz anders lesen. Es geht nämlich nicht um Transaktionen. Es geht um die Frage, welches Aktivum in dieser Welt zur Abwicklung dient, in dem Maße, wie sich die tokenisierte Finanzwelt entwickelt, also tokenisierte Anleihen, Sicherheiten, all diese Dinge. Und im Euroraum sind das bislang zu 99% Dollar. Für mich ist das ein Risiko. Und es ist ein Risiko, das sich durch europäische Regulierung nicht wegregulieren lässt. Wir müssen klüger vorgehen.
Der digitale Euro gilt in Frankfurt als Antwort auf die Abhängigkeit von amerikanischen Zahlungsdienstleistern. Reichlin verfolgt das Projekt seit Beginn und kommt zu einem ernüchternden Urteil über die konkrete Ausgestaltung. Ihr Maßstab ist aber die Frage, was digitales Zentralbankgeld können müsste, um für die nächste Generation des Zahlungsverkehrs gerüstet zu sein.
In principle, it could be revolutionary as an instrument, because it could be really the infrastructure, the public infrastructure, through which we have the new payment system of the future.
Im Prinzip könnte dieses Instrument revolutionär sein, denn es könnte tatsächlich jene öffentliche Infrastruktur sein, auf der das Zahlungssystem der Zukunft aufbaut. Aber so wie er konzipiert wurde, ist er ehrlich gesagt ziemlich nutzlos. Es gibt eine Obergrenze, es gibt keine Verzinsung. Und er ist nicht programmierbar, lässt sich also nicht an Smart Contracts anpassen. Die nächste Generation des technologischen Wandels im Zahlungsverkehr, agentische Zahlungen, also KI-Agenten, die Zahlungen auslösen, ist ein völlig neues Terrain. Der digitale Euro ist dafür nicht gerüstet. Er wurde für diesen Zweck nicht entworfen. Insofern ist das aus meiner Sicht ein Stück weit Zeitverschwendung.
So, I think that in a way this is a little bit of a waste of time.
Zeitverschwendung. Was für eine schöne pointierte Zusammenfassung. Ich erinnere an meine Folge mit Volker Wieland zum Thema digitaler Euro, der auch gesagt hat, dass der digitale Euro nichts anderes ist als eine Lösung auf der Suche nach dem Problem. Der Verdacht liegt nahe, dass es um ganz andere Dinge geht als das, was die EZB offiziell postuliert, unter anderem nämlich die Einschränkung von Bargeld. Doch kommen wir zurück zum Gespräch mit Reichlin und Zettelmeier. Bei aller Kritik an der EZB betonen sie, dass die Sorgen der Notenbank natürlich nicht aus der Luft gegriffen sind. Zettelmeier unterscheidet deshalb sorgfältig zwischen Risiken, die es auch in einer Welt mit nur einer einzigen Währung gäbe, und solchen, die erst aus dem Währungswettbewerb entstehen. Beginnen wir mit der ersten Kategorie.
First of all, it's really useful to distinguish, and we do this in our paper, between stablecoin risks that would arise if the world just consisted of one currency and one jurisdiction.
Erst einmal lohnt es sich zu unterscheiden, und das tun wir in unserem Papier, zwischen jenen Stablecoin-Risiken, die auch dann bestünden, wenn die Welt nur aus einer Währung und einer Rechtsordnung bestünde. Das sind die Risiken, die mit einer bestimmten Form der Finanzinnovation einhergehen. Sie sieht sehr sicher aus, ist es aber womöglich nicht in gleichem Maße. Konkret könnte es ein Run-Risiko geben. Wenn am Ende alle gleichzeitig ihre Stablecoins einlösen wollen, können die Emittenten ihr Versprechen, zum Nennwert zurückzuzahlen, in der realen Welt womöglich nicht einhalten. Der Grund ist, dass sie dann sämtliche Sicherheiten, mit denen die Stablecoins unterlegt sind, gleichzeitig verkaufen müssten.
The reason is that they need to sell all these collateral that the stablecoins are backed by at the same time.
Wenn Europa Stablecoins nicht bremsen, sondern einbetten will, was müsste dann konkret geschehen? Reichlin nennt drei Vorschläge aus dem Paper, geordnet nach ihrem Sprengstoffgehalt. Der dritte ist jener, an dem sich die Geister vor allem scheiden.
Well, in the paper we propose several things. We proposed to change the requirements.
In dem Papier schlagen wir mehreres vor. Erstens wollen wir die Anforderungen an die Aktivseite ändern, denn die machen das Geschäftsmodell praktisch kaputt. 60% in Bankeinlagen bedeutet, dass die Emittenten nicht genug verdienen, um tragfähig zu sein. Das ist wohl der am wenigsten umstrittene unserer Vorschläge.
More controversially, we are proposing to pay interest. This is something that not even the US is doing.
Kontroverser ist der zweite. Wir schlagen vor, Zinsen zu zahlen. Das machen nicht einmal die USA. Dieser Zinsgedanke ergänzt aber unseren dritten und umstrittensten Vorschlag, nämlich Stablecoins wirklich sicher zu machen. Im Prinzip sind sie ja bereits sehr sicher, aber eben nicht so sicher wie Banken, weil sie keinen Zugang zu den Reserven der Zentralbank haben. Und das ist unser dritter Vorschlag, der im Moment vielleicht verfrüht ist, weil der Stablecoin-Markt noch sehr klein ist.
Which maybe is now is premature because stablecoin is very, you know, small.
Die Debatte über Stablecoins führt am Ende zu einer sehr viel größeren Frage. Wie bankenzentriert soll Europas Finanzsystem eigentlich bleiben? Reichlin macht an dieser Stelle ausdrücklich klar, dass sie nur für sich alleine spricht und nicht für ihren Co-Autor.
If you want, like everybody in Europe wants, to move towards a less bank-centered,
wenn man, so wie alle in Europa, zu einem weniger bankzentrierten, stärker kapitalmarktorientierten Finanzsystem kommen will, dann wird das ohne eine Veränderung der Arbeitsweise der EZB nicht möglich sein. Das ist meine Aussage, nicht die von Jeremy, das will ich klarstellen. Wir haben darüber nie gesprochen. Aber der operative Rahmen der EZB ist nun einmal fast ausschließlich auf Banken zugeschnitten. Die Gegenparteien sind Banken. Es geht überwiegend um Kredite. Auch jetzt kehrt man ja zu einem nachfragegetriebenen Rahmen zurück, in dem die Bilanz in Abhängigkeit von der Kreditnachfrage der Banken ausgeweitet wird. Wenn sich das Finanzsystem nun verändert und deutlich marktorientierter wird, dann lautet die große Frage, ist das noch das richtige System oder ist es das nicht?
Zum Abschluss bringt Zettelmeier die Meinungsverschiedenheit mit der EZB auf eine Formel mit einem Vergleich, den er selbst allen Vorbehalten versieht. Es geht dabei um die Frage, wie man handelt, wenn man ein Risiko weder beweisen noch ausschließen kann.
So here's an analogy for you with lots of caveats. Think about the possibility that Saddam Hussein was developing.
Denken Sie an die Frage, ob Saddam Hussein Massenvernichtungswaffen entwickelte. Niemand wusste wirklich, ob er das getan hat. Es gab dieses Risiko. Wer es für groß genug hielt, für den rechtfertigte es die Invasion des Irak, etwas, das man sonst als völlig unüblich empfunden und nicht getan hätte. Wer das Risiko für sehr klein hielt, für den rechtfertigte es einen Angriff nicht. Aus Sicht der EZB begehen wir nun genau denselben Fehler, den die Amerikaner damals begangen haben.
Back then, because we have this risk out there, the US dollar stable coins are going to take over, and so let's change our modus operandi.
Soweit einige Auszüge aus meinem Gespräch mit Lucretia Reichlin und Jeremy Zettelmeier. Das ganze Gespräch, wie gesagt, gleich im Anschluss am Ende dieses Podcasts. Bevor wir dazu kommen, kurz meine Lehren. Erstens, die Geldform des Kapitalmarkts wird digital. Das Ganze ist bereits am Rollen und wir haben nicht die Frage, ob wir mitmachen wollen oder nicht. Wir müssen mitmachen. Ich denke, 28 Billionen Dollar Transaktionsvolumen sprechen für sich selbst. Die Tokenisierung von Wertpapieren, sekundenschnelle Abwicklung, programmierbare Zahlungsströme, das wird der Standard sein. Und wir können entscheiden, ob er mit oder ohne uns stattfindet. Zweitens, die USA setzen auf Sieg. Der Genius Act ist viel mehr als ein Regulierungsgesetz. Er ist ein strategischer Zug. Dollar-Stablecoins werden gefördert. Die Dollar-Hegemonie wird digital verlängert. Und US-Staatsanleihen bekommen einen neuen Käufer in einer Zeit, in der Washington die Käufer dringend gebrauchen kann. Drittens, die EZB hat sich institutionell entschieden. Sie wehrt sich gegen private Euro-Stablecoins. Aber ich denke, nicht aus ökonomischer, sondern aus institutioneller Logik. Sie will das Werkzeug in der eigenen Hand behalten. Der digitale Euro nimmt den Banken auch Einlagen weg. Nur mit dem Unterschied, dass die EZB ihn kontrolliert. Das ist nicht kohärent. Entweder man hat Sorgen um das Bankensystem oder eben nicht. Viertens, der digitale Euro ist keine Antwort. Er ist auf Endkunden ausgerichtet, er löst das Wholesale-Problem nicht und ohnehin fehlen ihm die digitalen Eigenschaften. Er ist, wie bereits angesprochen, die Lösung auf Versuche nach einem Problem. Der Brügel-Vorschlag, das ist mein fünfter Punkt, ist ein konkreter, pragmatischer Ausweg, wie wir doch noch zu einer europäischen, eurobasierten Infrastruktur kommen können. Die Maßnahmen sind einleuchtend und es gibt nichts, was dagegen spricht, diese umzusetzen. Und das führt mich zum Punkt 6. Ich denke, Deutschland und die Bundesbank sind gefordert. Die deutsche Position war offenbar nicht laut genug. Wenn Deutschland, historisch ein Land mit starken Bedenken gegen alles Kryptoähnliche, hier in eine konstruktive Rolle findet, könnte das die europäische Debatte kippen lassen. Ich denke, es lohnt sich. Wir können nicht von strategischer Autonomie sprechen und sehenden Auges in eine weitere strategische Abhängigkeit hineinstolpern. Soweit meine Gedanken zur heutigen Folge. Ich bin gespannt, wie immer, auf Ihre Fragen, Ihr Feedback, Ihre Kritik, Ihre Anregungen und freue mich auf ein Wiederhören am kommenden Mittwoch zur neuen Ausgabe von BTO Refresh und auf den kommenden Sonntag zur neuen Ausgabe von BTO. Das war's für heute, aber nicht vergessen, jetzt kommt noch das ganze Gespräch im Original. Viel Spaß damit, genießt die letzten Sommertage. Bis dahin, Ihr Daniel Stelter.
BTO, Beyond the Obvious, featured bei Handelsblatt.
Dear Lucrezia, dear German, it's a great pleasure welcoming you to my podcast.
We are very happy to be here.
Happy to be here.
I'm happy that you're happy to be here. My impression was the ECB was not so happy about your proposal and your discussion there, because you made a proposal concerning promoting stable coins in Europe. And the ECB said, oh, well, we are worried about the banking system. Oh, we don't want to have this and whatsoever. And I would like to discuss with you, what is a stable coin? Why should we do it? What are your thoughts about it? Is the ECB partially right? Or is the ECB probably mixing some stuff up with the digital euro whatsoever? So, why don't we dive in and quickly introduce stablecoins to our audience and then explain why having stablecoins in Europe might be of relevance.
Okay, so you're asking what is a stablecoin? Okay, stablecoin is issued by the private sector, non-bank private sectors. They issue something which looks like money, okay, that is backed by safe asset on the safe side, on the asset side. And in principle, has very little redeemable risk because of the quality of the asset which back the instrument. Of course, this is something relatively new in the financial sector. So regulators are trying to understand what does this mean? How does this relate to bank deposit? Is this money? Is this something else? Is it more similar to a money market mutual fund, or is it more similar to cash? And different regulators have taken a different stance on how to regulate it. Okay, so in the US, we have the Genius Act, and in Europe, we had MiCA. And there are several debates. So first of all, what safe means, so what is the asset that should be acceptable as backers? And as the other debate is, should this is this instrument pay interest or not? And it seems that on the second question, both the US and Europe have decided that stablecoin should not pay an interest, although there are some nuances on how to interpret the US legislation. While on what is accepted on the asset side, there are differences between the European regulation and the U.S. regulation. With the U.S. regulation accepting to have short-term treasury bonds, for example, while the European regulations, at least for systemic stablecoin, demands to have a 60% proportion of bank deposit. So this is one of the issues, okay, how should we structure, what regulated stablecoin should be like. But there are broader issues, or where is that our financial system is going towards in an era of tokenized finance. What does tokenized finance really change? Is it just about technology, or is it really about the nature of money? Maybe I will stop here, but I would be happy to expand.
We keep on discussing. Don't worry. We keep on. So I want to start slowly. Okay. We understand the concept of stablecoins. For me, I'm an old guy. For me, it's always very similar to money market fund, to be honest. I think it's just for me, it feels very much like a money market fund, which has digital tokens as a. I mean, it might be too short version.
Well, they don't pay interest. Remember that when money market mutual fund became very popular in the 70s, there was a big movement towards money market mutual funds because they paid interest, while stable coins don't pay interest. And in a way, they're even safer because, they are backed by very safe asset. Okay, so that in both cases, also in the U.S. case.
I would agree with Daniel that it's the closest analogy in the non-digital.
And I just think
world.
Because we come now out of a very low interest rate environment, and we could some economists would say, well, we might see a trend change. We might see more of a return of higher structural inflation rate, high interest rate. So down the road, you could envisage that also stable coins might earn some interest down the road. But I think we
frankly, I disagree. Okay, so that's because stable coin is really like cash. So in that sense, it's closer to money as we understand it than money market mutual funds. In a tokenized environment, you need something that acts like cash. And cash is stablecoin, or it could be central bank digital currencies. Okay, so these are cash type of instruments, and they are bearer instruments. So in that sense, they are different than a bank deposit because they are bearer instruments. So to the extent that a platform needs that kind of asset, stablecoin is unique and is very close to what we understand as cash in traditional finance.
Okay. Now we have cleared the definition. We want to start with, what are the issues, especially from a European perspective. So we start by the US. You know, my understanding is that the Trump administration is basically trying to grow the market for stablecoins significantly. I would also say they do so in order to secure funding for the government, because my understanding is they have basically a rule saying you have to buy T-bills. So, and then having stablecoins, US dollar stablecoins, basically being available globally, this could be a means of, you know, for securing funding for the US government for many people who live in jurisdictions where probably the rule of law is not so safe, or they're worried about their money in their local currencies. So my understanding was that the US is trying to basically be the big player in the stablecoin market, benefiting from its global standards, which it still has despite Donald Trump, and securing funding for the government. Would you agree on this assessment, and do you think this has any implications for Europe?
I agree on this assessment, although I would concede to some of the people who actually criticize us, but that stablecoin has been quite successful in emerging markets, but less so in developed markets. And so now there is a lot of studies coming in, and it looks like the success of stablecoin is really related to the efficiency of the payment system in a country. So in a country, in a jurisdiction like Europe with very efficient payment system, the case for stablecoin for retail is not that great. So I don't think that the US can hope that there will be a generalized use of stablecoin all over the world, okay? But it is true that at least, listening to Bessent, that they have made the case that stablecoin will push demand for U.S. Treasury, and in that sense will be a vehicle for continuing the exorbitant privilege, even in a geopolitical situation in which there are much movement towards fragmentation.
Maybe to add, so first, we should not create the impression that the US is applying some sort of financial repression to push people towards stablecoins that are backed by US treasuries. So the liquidity backing requirements in the Genius Act, which is the regulatory framework for stablecoins, actually does not require stablecoin issuers to hold treasuries in reserves. They can also hold cash demand deposits. But of course, there's an incentive to hold treasuries because they pay an interest. And so they naturally come out in favor. And then, I mean, the big point that I think Lucrezia was alluding to is that when it comes to international demand for US dollar stablecoins, of course, the US is starting from a situation where dollarization has been a widespread phenomenon in emerging markets and developing countries for many decades. And so this is just a reflection of lack of trust in domestic currencies in those countries, and the fact that the dollar is the number one reserves and the number one transaction currency. So if you're going to substitute away from your currency, you will go into US dollars. Now, in the past, that entailed some risks on its own. And among these were risks that, you know, where you keep those dollars, do you keep them physically? Do you have to travel to Miami? Do you have to keep them in a local bank, which might be fine, but that bank in part is part of a a local financial infrastructure that might itself not be completely safe. And so all these kind of costs and risks of holding US dollars in the past in analog form are reduced or eliminated by holding them through stablecoins. And so potentially this could further boost dollarization by making it much easier and safer to actually hold cash-like US dollar claims. So that's where the US starts from a very strong position. Now, I don't think in Europe, although many of us would like a stronger international role of the euro, we do not want the euro to substitute for domestic currencies. We don't actually want to replace the US dollar in quite that function, but we would like to maintain monetary control and regulatory control within the euro area. And this is why, widespread use of stablecoins in the euro area would raise some concerns. But this is probably where you're going to go next.
No, but at least it's a risk. And you basically say, in order to avoid this risk, or also in order to be more attractive as a capital market, Europe should also be more open towards stablecoins.
Yeah, but I really would like to be precise here, because there have been a lot of discussion on the numbers and what do we really mean and so on. So I think there is a risk of what we call infrastructure dollarization in Europe. So this is not what Jeremy was mentioning in relationship to developing countries or countries which have a risk of inflation or capital controls or other things like that. So we are talking about something which is not about retail, so not at people who want to use dollars because they don't trust the euros or because our payment system is not efficient. Our payment system is very efficient. But it is a risk which has to do with the development of tokenized finance. As long as tokenized finance is going to develop, we are still early stage, so the numbers are still small. So in tokenized finance, especially in what we call permissionless platforms, so we need an instrument which is not a deposit, because a deposit needs a bank account. So it's not a tokenized deposit. It needs something like cash. And this could only be retail CBDC or stablecoin. So if Europe says we don't like stablecoin because we like tokenized deposit, because this is the new technology with issuers that we know and understand how to regulate, the banks, and so we want to block stablecoin, they can do so, but they cannot prevent the development of US stablecoins in the European market. So that means, and this is what we mean in the paper by infrastructure dollarization. It's a very important concept that people have not fully understood, because if you believe that this is a risk, then you have to look at the numbers and the development of stablecoin in a different way. It is not about transactions. It is really about, to what extent as tokenized finance develops, so tokenized bonds, collateral, all these kind of things that are developing. So what is the settlement asset in this world? And so far in the euro area, 99% is dollar-based. So to me, this is a risk. It is something that cannot be regulated away by European regulation. And so we have to be smarter. And this is the old discussion, okay? Well, one discussion is, does it matter? I mean, is it big enough to worry about? And the other discussion is, if we think it is a real risk, how should we go about?
But now we have this discussion also on the digital euro. And at the digital euro, the official argumentation is, and please correct me, is we need it because all our payment systems come from the US, Visa, whatever. So we need, that's at least what the ECB says, we need the digital euro to make this happen. So now if I listen to you, I would say in order to be relevant, and if you don't want to have a US, not an infrastructure dollarization, another dollarization, another area, that's why we need European stable coins. So basically, isn't this the same argument? You say, you know, we need a digital euro for having a European infrastructure, and we need a European stable coin. So is the ECB not inconsistent in being pro a digital euro and against the stable coin?
Well, I mean, the ECB actually, I think, has changed the communication, because at the beginning, when they communicated about their CBDC retail project, they insist on payment system and on sovereignty on payment system. But actually, retail CBDC has nothing to do with payment system, because payment system, what Europe worries about is Visa, MasterCard, the interface of our payment system. This is where Europe has lost, basically control. And so CBDC, retail CBDC, it is something else. And I think, on this, I'm not sure that that Jeremy agrees with me, but I wrote about that I think is more of a symbolic significance to have an instrument which is like cash, but, now that everybody's digitalized, so this is actually, it's euro. So for the European citizen, no matter where they are, they have this digital instrument. In principle, it could be revolutionary as an instrument, because it could be really the infrastructure, the public infrastructure through which we have the new payment system of the future. But the way in which they have designed makes it quite useless, frankly, because there is a limit, there is no interest payment. So it's also not programmable, so they cannot, adapt to smart contracts. So in the next generation of technological change in payments, agentic, AI agents making payments, I mean, that's a new frontiers. The digital euro is not ready for that. It's not, it's not been designed for that purpose. So I think that in a way, this is a little bit of a waste of time.
So, but basically, listening to you, it's two thoughts. One thought is, it's my comment, not you. I would say as ECB proves that if the government is doing it, it takes too long, and therefore they are behind the curve, because a stable coin, you would regulate the market for stable coins, but the offering would be coming from the private sector, and the private sector is more dynamic. Huh? The second point is, I think the limit on the digital euro, as you mentioned, the minimum or the maximum amount you can hold as a private person, is always been done with the argument we want to stabilize the banking system, because we don't want to. But in stable coins, the issue is also the banking system, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the same argument, as you say. So the fear of disintermediation is behind the design of retail CBDC, so holding limits and no interest rate. And the same fear is behind the design of MiCA for regulating stable coin, this no interest, and also the requirement on the asset side that I was describing before. So in a way, you can say that we are in a bank-based financial system in Europe, and the regulators are very much concerned that with the, if this instrument, becomes more, used, then there will be a flight from banks and from retail deposits, and this will be very costly. Okay, so we discussed this in the paper, so maybe, Jeremy, you want to...
Yeah, but then tell me, because you say, okay, fine, but we should nevertheless do it, and you ask for basically a hybrid architecture. You say basically we can make it happen. So I think you made the case for stable coins. So, but how can we make it happen? How can we, first of all, probably the ECB is not right with this criticism. Probably they're just wrong. Or probably they should not worry about the banking system, because it's just normal competition. They should not be protecting the old, I would say, necessarily. So what's your view of how to overcome this issue and why it's worth the fight for?
I think, of course, that they have to be concerned in the stability of the financial system, because that's their job. And I'm very happy that they're taking it very seriously. So, I mean, in that sense. But I don't think that you can base an argument for financial stability on the idea that because we know how to regulate the banks, we have to protect the banks no matter what. I think that Europe has very inefficient banks, and the banks are an incredibly powerful lobby in Europe. So we need to have a financial system which is much more open to competition, including from non-banks. And then, of course, there is a question of design, okay? So that you don't want to create like, you know, a flight to deposit all of a sudden. But remember that if you have a flight from deposit from banks into, let's say, stablecoin or CBDC, you know, the central bank can recycle this money and can lend to banks so that, and so to replace the deposit base of banks through loans. Now, this, of course, if you put it to an extreme, if you push it to an extreme, it becomes a completely public sector driven type of model. And so we don't necessarily want that, but we want a hybrid where different instruments can compete. And of course, they are all regulated properly.
I would like to sort of maybe just defend the ECB a little bit or clarify how I think they see the risks. So I think, first of all, it's really useful to distinguish, and we do this in our paper, between stablecoin risks that would arise if the world just consisted of one currency and one jurisdiction. Okay? And those, you know, the risks associated with a particular form of financial innovation, which, you know, looks very safe, but may not be as safe. So particularly, there may perhaps be a run risk. So in the end, if everyone wants to redeem their stablecoins at the same time, then the stablecoin holders may not be able to actually stick to their promise of redeeming them at par. And the reason is that they need to sell all these collateral that the stablecoins are backed by at the same time. So that's been prominently made, that point. And another point that, you know, we are a little more doubtful about, but that has also been very prominently made, is that, you know, we are a very bank dependent system, for better or worse, in Europe. Lucrecia just said maybe for worse. And, you know, given that, clearly, if there is a flight away from deposits and people instead hold stablecoins for payments purposes, this may hurt financial intermediation. The banks would have a harder time to get funding, and as a result, the cost of credit might go up. So this, we don't completely buy this argument, at least not in a crude form, but this is an argument that is powerful and has been made.
But I have another, just to add, I mean, since we say that the stablecoin is primarily not a retail instrument, I think it's not a real substitute for retail deposits. So I think this fear of disintermediation,
it's overdone.
I don't say at the same time stablecoin is nothing, you know, the numbers are very small and so on, which is one answer we got. And at the same time to say we should not push it because this will create disintermediation for banks. I mean, if it is mostly a wholesale instrument, as we say, and it seems to be the case if you look at the numbers, then, you know, I think the fear of disintermediation at the retail level is overblown.
Fair point. But these are sort of the two baseline risks in a complete early one currency world. And then basically what the point that we make is we're not in a one currency world. And so you have extra risks that come from the fact that stable coins right now are completely dollar dominated. And so this is where your question came in, Daniel. Is the ECB inconsistent by not worrying about this dollarization risk in the context of stable coins, but on the other hand, arguing for a digital euro with arguments that also sound about protecting ourselves from the US in a broad sense? And the answer is no, the ECB is not being inconsistent. So the ECB is consistent because they are talking about quite different things. So when they argue for the digital euro as a sort of safety net, they're making a really economic security argument, right? So this is about Visa and MasterCard interrupting their functions because of some terrible political pressure in the US, something like that. That's the argument they have in mind. So what they have in mind is that, you know, there is a powerful outside agent that can do to European Visa holders what actually we in Europe did to the poor Greeks when they couldn't get cash out of their machines anymore, right? So we interrupt the access to their payable system for, you know, different reasons, but this is the result. So that's not the risk that we are talking about.
But also, if I can, you know, I'm the tougher one, okay? I'm the more critical one of the ECB than Jeremy. So, I mean, the real competition to at the retail level is not stablecoin, but, you know, is Revolut, you know, Wise, you know, all these fintech companies.
Uh-huh.
They can actually, their fees and their spreads is much smaller than the one of stablecoin. Also for remittance and for international payments. So, and those actually, and this is a different discussion. So, I mean, stablecoin is not really about that. Okay. And so if Europe wants really to take the sovereignty argument seriously, you know, this is where they should worry about. They should worry about fintech, and they should worry about MasterCard and Visa. And of course, this, I think, is a very legitimate concern.
But they do, right?
But so we agree. It's not with CBDC, that because CBDC is not for international payments and so on. So that
not for international payments, but you want a payment infrastructure that's completely autonomous, so you can keep daily
life. Of course,
going,
but
right?
In no market economy, we have a system in which the payment infrastructure is 100% public. Okay, so it's nowhere in the world. Okay, so I mean, if you want to worry about payments, you have to make sure that you know, you do not have, you know, all kind of issues, segmentation and balkanization issues within Europe. And because this is really the big cause of why we don't have a European Visa, okay, or something like that. We have SEPA, which is very efficient, but we do not have the interface.
Okay, but probably, you know, we made the case for stablecoins in Europe. So, but what is necessary of getting, you know, having a higher share? You point out that from the transaction points of view, we have a very high share of transactions, 30% about, but, you know, we have a very low share. I think 0.23% of all global stable coins are issued in Europe. So what should we do? What should we do about it to basically support the growth of stable coins in Europe?
Well, in the paper, we proposed several things. We proposed to change the requirements on asset, because that basically kills the business model, because 60% in deposit, you know, means that they don't make enough money to be viable. This is maybe the least controversial thing that we are proposing. More controversially, we are proposing to pay interest. This is something that not even the US is doing. But this idea of paying interest is complementary to our third proposal, which is the most controversial, which is to say that to make it safe, I mean, stablecoin in principle, they're already very safe, but, you know, they are not as safe as banks because they do not have access to the reserve facility of the central bank. So this is our third proposal. Which maybe is now is premature because stablecoin is very, you know, small. But, you know, it's something that, you know, for example, the Bank of England is doing, and, you know, it's something that you have to get in mind as a possibility for the future. Now, if you give us a stablecoin to reserves and you pay interest, then this is a good thing also for the transmission mechanism of monetary policy, because you will have an interest rate, which is a policy rate, and interest rate, which is the interest rate on reserves that bank pays. And you have an interest that you pay on stablecoin issues, maybe lower, like in the US, it is, for example, for money market mutual fund. And so that would allow the ECB to control the transmission of its interest rate policy. So this is quite radical, and you know, it may be premature in the sense, as I said, that you know, stablecoin is still tiny, okay, but it is something that would boost the use of stablecoin in Europe and provide a real competition for U.S.
While maintaining safety.
While maintaining safety, of course.
That's an important thing. So, right, yeah. So we do agree with the ECB and most of the critics that stablecoins pose some risk.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we could,
yes.
I mean, if we could just wish them away, or if it would just go away, that would be fine. So we have nothing against the ECB's vision of digital finance, where stablecoins just play a minor role. Digital finance takes mostly the form of tokenized deposits, not dollarized, euro tokenized deposits. Then you have a wholesale digital infrastructure that's run by the ECB underlying it. And then you have the digital euro as sort of a last resort instrument that normally doesn't play a very big role. So we have nothing against this vision. We're just saying that if you want to pursue this vision by being very tough on stablecoins, so you keep them small as a competitor against tokenized deposits, you're running a big risk that you're also keeping euro stablecoins very small, while your ability to keep the dollar stablecoins small is much less because people can go and hold them anyway.
But I think you cannot stop the growth. And by the way, on risk, I remember that, you know, breaking the buck, coming back to the old money market fund, but breaking the buck was always an issue. And my understanding was in the financial crisis, this happened. And as it happened, the Fed intervened. So in the end, you know, you might say, okay, they don't have access to the ECB, but in the financial stress crisis, they
quite
will. In practice, they will have an access because
and this
otherwise.
This is what happened in the US very recently with SVB, you know, when the Fed basically had to intervene to stabilize the circle.
Yes. Yes. And so, but on tokenized deposits, just to clarify, because, you know, it might be. When you speak about because currently when I have a bank account, I don't have a tokenized deposit. I just have a bank account. Yeah. And if I'm worried about the stability of my bank, I think stablecoins offer more safety, to be honest. So I would probably be rather be inclined to hold more into stablecoins than in the banking system. Depends on the country, but you could say so. And then the point for me is, you know, tokenized deposits, I don't have on offer. Tokenized deposits is what the banks are holding at the ECB. But I don't as an individual, if I want to have something tokenized, stablecoins would be currently the only path, or down the road, the digital euro, if it comes with strange arguments, and as Lucrezia pointed out, and with lacking the core functions it should have.
Well, tokenized deposit, so far we haven't seen tokenized deposit yet, okay? So there are lots of projects, JP Morgan and so on, but one day, you will have your tokenized deposit and it will be exactly like your normal deposit, like your old-fashioned deposit. There will be, a wholesale central bank money, so that will settle in the interbank market, these digital deposits and tokenized deposits. So in a way, it's going to be exactly the same as we have now, but with a new technology. So tokenized deposit, it would base on this accounting system, okay? So that in order to have a tokenized deposit, you have to have banks, and you have to have an interbank market, which is compatible and so on. The question, I think, is whether, so this would be like a permission chain in the vocabulary of this world, which will have the same structure as our monetary system today. The question is whether, together with this permission chain, we will have a development of permissionless chains. And then in these permissionless chains, you need an instrument which is not a deposit, but is a bearer instrument. And in that case, that would be a stable coin. And then people maybe can choose between the two. I'm talking about the future, And what is interesting is that in Europe, the banks themselves are worrying about these developments. And this is why the banks themselves think of the Qui Vallis project. They intend to issue stable coins through, special vehicles. So the banks are edging right now. Okay. So they're both, some banks, they're doing tokenized deposits. Some banks are doing stable coins. Some banks are doing both. So the banks are hedging. The ECB is not hedging. The ECB has decided that tokenized deposit is what they want. So in that sense, I think it's, you know, we are still, we don't know where the world will go. But as a good regulators, I think it would be a good idea just to also to hedge, okay, to see what,
I mean, the reason why the ECB didn't like our paper so much is that the type of hedging that we are advocating requires it to do a lot, right? It requires actually changing the rules. It requires giving new institutions access to the ECB's balance sheet, meaning that they can deposit reserves there, but they can also borrow from the ECB. It would not make the banks happy that are powerful, and of course that the ECB is very worried about because they are so central to the European financial system. So we are basically telling them, look, there is a real chance that this growth of US dollar stablecoins could be a problem. At the same time, we understand that you don't simply want to promote stablecoins in a dumb way because that would generate its own risks. But we have a solution for you, which is promote euro stablecoins in a way that really embraces them and puts them within the regulated and supervised system and, you know, gives them access to liquidity. And then everything will be fine. And we have the best of both worlds. You know, we have our own stable coins and they're very safe. So that's our pitch. But then the ECB says, yeah, but in order to get there, you are forcing me to completely change the way we operate.
And if I can add, I think there is a broader issue here, which is not the the topic of our conversation. But I mean, if you want, like everybody in Europe wants to move towards a less bank-centered model of finance and a more capital market model of finance, this is not going to be possible without a change in how the ECB operates. This is my statement, it's not Jeremy's statement, to be clear, you know, because we never discussed it. But I think that the way in which the operational framework of the ECB works is very much only banks. The counterparty are banks. Is mostly loans. I mean, also now they're returning to you know, a demand-driven framework in which, you know, they will expand their balance sheet in relationship to the demand for loans by banks and so on. Now, as the finance changes and becomes much more market-oriented, then the big question is that the good system or not?
Yeah, that's why you speak about embedding instead of containing.
Yeah.
So I think that you made the case clear, but the point for me is, you know, what should now be changed? The ECB should give access to the stablecoin operators to ECB balance sheet in case of problem or for lending, as you pointed out. We should have a regulatory framework like in the US, basically making it, or what would you propose in order to make this happen? Because, okay, now the ECB says we don't want to do it, but let's move on. We now do the podcast and they listen to the podcast and they agree. In the end, they say, okay, they made a good point and we have to change our view, or we have to change our view because we otherwise see that the financial system of Europe falls further behind compared to other countries. So what are the concrete steps?
I think that, it is likely that the European Commission will slightly change the MiCA regulation. They are still doing consultations. Okay, so I'm a little bit more optimistic about the requirement of MiCA on stablecoin. On the rest, on the access to reserves, I don't think this is going to happen, not in the foreseeable future. But I mean, if we have a financial problem, okay, like say SPB, you know, a stable coin issue, I think that the ECB will act as lender last resort, because this has always happened in the history of finance, that when you have to fix a liquidity crisis, the ECB comes in and does it. But this is about crisis mode, it's not about the normal system, okay, so that's a different story. Now, is this going to be a risk? I think not in the short run, because I think we are really early stage. So, but if you talk to the banks rather than people like us, like with Qivalis, and you ask why is Société Générale investing in stablecoin rather than tokenized deposit, And they do it because they are concerned about the same things we are concerned about. And if the standards are set on the dollar-backed stablecoin, on the dollar standards, then it's very difficult to go back because, you know, money has this property of network externality. So once it becomes dollar, then it's dollars. And so that's why the European banks are investing in that.
Okay, let's assume the ECB changes the rules. We have now a much more favorable regulation for stablecoins. We still have the issue in Europe that, you know, the European financial market is underdeveloped compared to the US. And we have the ongoing discussion. I know, and you, Jerome, you just published about it again. We always have the discussion around the euro safe asset. Could you imagine the ECB taking a different stance had we such a European safe asset?
I'm not sure it's directly related. So I think if we had an EU safe asset, meaning if we had a much larger stock of commonly issued bonds, safe bonds out there, right? That's what we mean by a safe asset like the US. I think the political economy of stablecoins would change because the European Treasury or the European Finance Minister would get behind EU
like in the US
stablecoins, like in the US. But I think that would be the main effect. I mean, other than that, I think that, first of all, of course, the ECB has been advocating or been sympathetic to an EU safe asset. But I think in this case, they see a trade-off between risks, right? So there are two risks and one constraint from this ECB's perspective, as I understand it. There is the risk of having euro stable coins grow too much and create problems on its own, regardless of the dollarization issue. Then there is the risk of infrastructure dollarization and ultimately dollarization, pure and simple. Because you're importing by holding dollar-denominated assets, you're importing risks from the U.S., currency risks, liquidity risks, and so forth. So there are these two risks. And what we are basically telling them is you can get rid of the second risk, dollarization risk, without having more risk via the inherent stability problems of stablecoins if you deeply embed stablecoins into the monetary and financial system. So basically, we're telling them we have a way for you to reduce the second risk without, you know, becoming more stablecoin dependent, but it requires a major step. And this, for the ECB, violates a constraint. And the constraint is that they do not want to change the European financial system too much. And in particular, they do not want to really, at least in the short term, do much about our bank dependency. And so that's why they come out. And now the point, though, is it's a consistent position. If you think that dollar-based stablecoins are plateauing anyway, right? If you think that this is going to solve itself, this problem, and that we can offer the potential European holders of US dollar stablecoins a strong alternative, which is some combination of the digital euro with tokenized deposits, then we don't have to worry about the whole problem. That's where they're coming from.
Yeah, and I think at this point, frankly, the issue is really one of interpretation of the data and of what's happening in the market. A lot of our colleagues and a lot of people who are close to the ECB, they think that the risk of development of dollar stablecoin is actually minimal. And if you think that is minimal, then their attitude is quite justified. Okay, so it is more gradual. So I want to be open to the possibility that we are wrong, of course. But I think at least it's very important to understand what we are talking about. We are not talking about retail. Okay, so we are talking about the wholesale market. And in a lot of debates I participated in the last few months, I see that this is not clear. Okay, and this has to be a very clear concept. And the form in which tokenized finance will develop here and in the US is not clear yet. Okay. So because we still don't know whether we will be in this kind of unified ledger like the BIS wants, in which everything is permission and central bank money is at the center of it, or is we are going to have these open chains in which, of course, stablecoin would be the primary cash instrument. So this we'll see, okay? But it's not something that is easy to regulate, okay? So in a way, this is a little bit out of hands than the regulators. So they would like to happen something that they know rather than something that they don't know, but they cannot actually determine the outcome.
Okay, so you cannot regulate a market you don't know. I understand this, but I have two questions, which are some, I need to understand a little bit better the network effect of dollar stable coins on the wholesale market. I need to understand that what is it, really the problem. But before it becomes a problem, I want to ask a probably very, very simple and most probably stupid question. If I were a finance minister of Italy or France, running huge deficits or having huge debt levels, I would probably say, encourage my banks to set up stable coins and then back them with my bonds, like the US is doing. So a highly indebted European country could have an incentive to do so. And then German or Dutch or whoever might hold these stable coins and not knowing necessarily basically supports the funding of a government. Is this currently not possible due to legislation? Or could this be could we basically just have it happening in spite of the ECB not being really keen on it?
This is not possible because MiCA doesn't allow. But I mean, you could think if you were a very imaginative regulator to say you can hold government bonds only in the proportions of the capital key. So you can hold a synthetic bond as asset. And so that will increase, you know, so you could you could consider, the bonds of the existing common debt, you know, as eligible asset for stablecoin. I mean, you could do, I mean, there is a lot of room for creativity there.
But I can't do it to benefit, as a French finance minister, I can't do it because of MiCA. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, let's assume...
But can I just say, Daniel, the other thing you can do is to basically encourage your banks that are already holding your bonds
yeah.
to issue, to get going with tokenized deposits. So they become more attractive to, the potential users of stable coins. So their deposit bases grow and then they reinvest those deposits in your assets, right? So that would be actually much more logical. But we don't see this happening either. So one thing that is, I don't know, a little bit of a puzzle, but Lucrezia probably has insights on this, is why banks are not more aggressive on tokenized deposits. So we have actually seen banks being quite creative in Europe on stable coins, more so than
because
on tokenized.
It's much more difficult because tokenized deposits have to be within their ledger. And they have a lot of legacy technology. So it's much more difficult.
It's more difficult.
And then once they have it, is within their ledger so that, you know, this is, they can do all kind of thing, you know, within the same bank, network, but A to B is complicated. In that sense, this is why they're diversifying. I'm worried about, American banks like JP Morgan being at the frontier of the development of tokenized deposit because this problem of scale that normally a bank has because you have tokenized deposit will have to be in the same ledger is less so for a cross-border big American banks. So, I mean, by encouraging tokenized deposit, we may encourage American banks to dominate actually our means of exchange, our means of payment.
Basically, now let's assume the ECB does not listen, it doesn't change. So one risk is tokenized deposits are basically done by the Americans. Uh-huh. And you also said, okay, that would be the retail. This would affect me. But then you said several times, well, the main risk is on the wholesale side. And you said basically of the network effect. So if nothing happens, how could our world look like in 5 or 10 years' time? How would Europe's finance system then look like and how autonomous or lacking autonomy would be the system?
Okay, so let me say one thing to make clear. So if the world develops as a unified ledger, you say the European unified ledger with central bank money, banks, with and tokenization, smart contracts within that ledger, then there is not much use for stablecoin. Tokenized deposit within that ledger can be used as cash. If, on the other hand, there will be also these open platforms, and these open platforms, people say this open, who is interested in open platform? I mean, if you have open platforms, then you cannot rely on the interbank. Okay. So you have to have stablecoin. So then the question comes who actually wants this open ledger, and in what sense they solve the problem? I mean, is it, do they really solve the problem? And here the question is, in the developing world, of course, they solve the problem of the non-banker, the people who are non-banked. But okay, in Europe, we are all banked, okay, so we don't have that problem. But an open ledger can accommodate agentic payments. Yeah. And this is one... It can also, anybody who is outside the countries and doesn't hold a euro account, for example, but you will not be able to, operate within that ledger. I mean, unless there is a development of this wholesale with other countries, there are some projects at the BIS, but I mean, this is really going very slowly. So there will be some demand, okay, for open ledgers. And then, in that case, I think for the way things are going, my prediction is that the open ledgers, we will have dollars.
And then we would not be in a position to do monetary policy as effective?
Well, I mean, that depends on the size, okay? So if the open ledgers remain peripheral, maybe this is not a big problem, but it's another, vehicle for strengthening the role of the dollar. So now if you want to have the euro internationalization, you want to be a big player, there are basically three models. There is the US model. Everything is open. Everybody does whatever they want within a regulatory perimeter. There is the European hybrid, not clear where we are going model. And then there is the Chinese model, which is also very smart because they have CBDC retail, which pays interest. So that's a real competition to their private sector payment system. So they design it in a very different way than we have. And then they have this bridge project, which link wholesale Chinese money to the wholesale money of their partners so that then they can solve the cross-border aspect with their trading partners. So that's one way in which Europe could go if they don't like the American pro-market, type of stuff. But Europe doesn't want to go that way. They have already said it, okay? They have designed CBDC in a completely different way. So we are in between these two extremes.
You say we are in between these two extremes, and I would say we have no clear strategy, and that's why we lose out.
Well, I mean, if you talk to the central bankers, I tell you what they will tell you. Say that we think that this problem is bigger than we think. The demand for stablecoin will remain limited because fintech are much more efficient than stablecoin for remittance and cross-border payments. And that permissionless chain will remain very much a smaller part of the system than the permission chains. And then, the real competition is on how transparent and good your regulation are. And so we will be safer and therefore we will be more attractive.
They definitely have a strategy. The strategy is
very clear.
The strategy is in Christine Lagarde's speech that she gave shortly before we presented our paper. I think it was in May, right? In early May. And so the strategy is to try to place a bet on the technology, but, for lack of a better word, and she probably didn't say this word, suppress stable coins, right? So they want to promote digital technology. They want particularly to, and they are, promoting interoperability between digital ledger technology platforms and ECB payment systems as the form of maintaining monetary control and making sure that the ECB remains at the heart of the system. But then as far as the payments instruments are concerned, they have a clear preference for tokenized deposits. Why? Because they are within the regulated banking system that they know well, that they control well, that they're used to. And so it doesn't change the way they normally operate to have digitalization through this channel. That's their approach. And you can defend this approach by saying that if you are really worried about stablecoins as generating new risks, even if they are euro stablecoins, this is a sensible strategy. The weak flank is that you are vulnerable to US dollar-based stablecoin growth. And so in order for this strategy to make sense, you have to argue that that risk is small. And they have argued that to us. If you really believe that the strategy, that risk is small, you shouldn't do drastic things. And what we are proposing in our paper, in their view, is drastic, right? So here's an analogy for you, which we, you know, with lots of caveats, think about the possibility that Saddam Hussein was developing weapons of mass destruction. You know, no one really knew whether he was developing weapons of mass destruction. There was a risk out there. If you thought that risk was big enough, it justified the invasion of Iraq, which otherwise would have been something very unusual you wouldn't have wanted to do. If you think that risk was very small, it didn't. So, you know, for the ECB, we are committing the same error that the Americans committed back then, because we have this risk out there, oh, the US dollar stablecoins are going to take over, and so let's change our modus operandi. And, you know, the ECB's message to us is, guys, this could have lots of unintended consequences, and we just don't believe that the risk is very high. And our answer is, well, we hope you're right. But you're taking a risk, right? That's the point.
I would say it's a nice way of closing our conversation for, we could continue for hours, but I think I promise you just 1 hour. My takeaway is a little bit that I say, well, you know, I'm more as a camp of people believing into the market. And I would be surprised if, you know, the ECB has a better understanding of what's successful in the market is in the future than the people being in the market. So, but that's my personal view. Thank you very much for this technical conversation. And I think it was a good discussion. Hope for you as well. And thank you very much also for taking the time during your holidays.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
A real pleasure.